What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Facade. I'm your host, Gavin J. Gallagher, and on this podcast, I explore the mental and emotional game often playing out subconsciously, both in your mind and the mind of everyone else in the real estate or property investment market. The key to success in this game is to master your mindset and behavior, to take control of your thoughts, your emotions, and most importantly, your ego. Welcome to the show. Guys, real quick before we begin, I have created a brand new accelerator program. It kicks off in mid-May and has an in-person welcome event starting on the 1st of June. I've put a ton of work into building this course, and it's important to point out that this is not a novice level program. It's for people who own property and want to be involved in the property business. It's aimed at time poor business owners, corporate executives, and professionals who might harbor ambitions to build their own property portfolio with the potential to fully replace their salary. Now, you may not want to leave your job, or you may not want to give it up or anything like that, but I think you will see the value of having options beyond selling your time for money. If this sounds of interest, please click the link below to book a call with me to discuss whether or not you're a right fit for the program. I do look forward to meeting you in June if you are, and working closely with you on this exciting journey. Now, back to the show. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode. And this week, my family are away on vacation, and so I had the entire weekend to catch up on work and to get this week's episode out nice and early. So here I am on Monday morning with the latest episode, unlike the last couple of weeks where it's been coming out kind of late. And so apologies for that. This week, I'm going to be talking about some funding strategies that I'm seeing put to good use. And I have discovered lately that funding is a major issue for pretty much everybody who's out there. How do I know this? Well, let me explain by way of an update. And this is something that I've been working on for the past week. And it's really insightful when you ask a question of a community. And that's what I've done. And so firstly, as you may have heard in the past week, either through the newsletter or through last week's podcast or through my social media, I have created a new community in an app called School. And many of you joined last week on foot of hearing about it. Wherever you heard about it, I just got inundated with a lot of people clicking the invitation and joining. And so as of today, in the space of just 7 days, we now have 102 members in the community. And I'm really pleased with that. That's a pretty good uptake. And so it shows that the communication is working, at least. When you join the school community, it asks you a couple of questions. And one of the questions that I ask is, what is the biggest challenge that is facing you? And overwhelmingly, the response has been funding. The answers, I would say 80 out of the 100 people who responded to that question said something along the lines of raising money, getting access to capital, funding the project, whatever it might be. And so that is something that I'm going to talk about today. And it's actually, before I do though, I just want to quickly mention a couple of things. This is just before we jump into the main topic. First thing I want to say is that you got to be careful out there. There is a couple of scammers around, and generally speaking, and also specifically related to some of my content. So over in TikTok, those of you who follow me on TikTok, you will be aware I have about 8,500 followers, and I've had quite a few videos go quite viral. And so it's a good place to go and, post content and stuff. But anywhere that, is successful tends to attract the wrong kind of people as well. And so what's happened is somebody has created a copycat account. It's identical looking to my account. And it has fewer followers and it doesn't have as many likes and things like that. But it looks very, very similar. And what this person is doing is reaching out by direct message, and he's saying, "Hey, Gavin here, just want to, make you aware of an investment opportunity that I'm looking at." And it then talks about 400% return in the space of 7 days and all sorts of like ridiculously over sort of egged numbers. But if you're not, you know, fully sort of clued in, you might fall for this. Click on a button and next minute that maybe your bank account's been hacked or something like that. So guys, be very, very careful. I don't talk about crypto investments, full stop. I talk about perhaps its comparison with real estate as an investment, but I would never, ever suggest that you invest in a particular type of crypto or something like that. It's just not something I do. I'm seeing this all the time. Every time you comment on a YouTube video of some big, you know, celebrity or some influencer, you'll end up getting inundated with guys' messages. It's all bots, as they call them, responding automatically saying, hey, you know, invest in this. And they suggest a WhatsApp number. And they have all sorts of ways to bypass the, you know, the filters that they have to stop this stuff. Anyway, no sooner had I set up my school group yesterday or in the last couple of days, yesterday, somebody joined the group from New York City. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. What's somebody from New York doing joining this group? I had a look and approved them. And next minute, messages popping up all over the place about a crypto. Please invest in crypto. What they were doing is commenting after certain people's posts. They were replying to people. So I went in and I checked this, and there was at least 10 posts in the space of about 2 minutes, 10 posts. So this is clearly some sort of a bot that has been created to automatically do this. And I got another request earlier today from another New York-based, and I could just tell that it is not real. I can actually tell now, there's a couple of telltale signs. You look for vagueness around where did you find me? And it says something like online as opposed to, you know, TikTok or podcast. Because if they say something like Facebook, I haven't posted anything about this in Facebook. And therefore, that would be a bit of a red flag for me. So they just say online. And I've been figuring this out. So anyway, look, I'm not going to go on too much, but just needless to say, investing in crypto is not really on brand with me. So pay attention. Don't fall for it. And just report the, you know, if you're getting this kind of message, just report them as scammers. And that should be, hopefully we'll get rid of them. Anyway, let's get back to the main topic on funding. And as I see it, there is a sequence that you need to think about and that you need to kind of follow if you're going to successfully apply, you know, raise funding for a project. And that's whether or not it's an investment funding or a lender putting the money into the deal. But there's many, many misconceptions. And I've seen people that have a little bit of knowledge, they can get themselves into trouble. And you have to be quite careful when you're investing in property. And some of these misconceptions, you know, people, they give up way too quickly because they're not aware of the stuff that they're doing wrong. So I'm going to attempt to outline the sequence as I see it. And, you know, number one on your road to successfully funding a deal, it's the deal itself. I mean, it goes without saying, but I'm not sure people are aware of the scrutiny that you need to give your deal. And, you know, if you're presenting a deal to an investor or a lender, they're going to look behind at some of this stuff. And if you haven't done your homework, well, then that is the reason why the deal is going to be rejected. But they're not necessarily going to take you aside and say, you didn't do this, 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 and this, and that's why we're rejecting. They'll just say mortgage not approved or, you know, loan not approved. And you'll be left scratching your head thinking it's impossible. Now, a lot of novice investors, and I've spoken to a number of them that have joined the various communities I've set up and the masterminds and things like that. And I have found that there is two areas that they seem to fall into, or two categories. The first one is they think that they've bought in a good area and that is enough to make, you know, for a lender or a bank or something to lend you the money. That is not enough. A good area, there's an awful lot of nuance behind what makes a good area. So I'll go into that in a moment. But the other thing is people look at what they can afford, and that's exclusively as far as they go. They don't look at the economics of the deal. They just look at, can they make the payments? Can they raise the money for the deposit? and can they cover the monthly payment amounts? And that's as far as they look at the numbers. And that is just way too little analysis. And I'm going to explain some of the things that you need to do to actually successfully get your deal over the line. Now, the problem with such a narrow analysis is that it doesn't pass the smell test effectively. For example, I mentioned a good location or a good area. Now, what does that mean? Who do you mean for, you know, if I say it's a good area, who am I referring to it would be a good area for? So, for example, if I am looking to find a place for my family, well, then a good area is somewhere that is, you know, safe and that has got, you know, a school nearby, that has got maybe playgrounds in the area, a park, and, you know, that's what would make a good area. But if I'm trying to rent a property to, say, a bunch of students, then a good area is close to the college. Or if I'm trying to, you know, accommodate, say, nurses or medical practitioners, a good area would be close to the hospital. And if I'm trying to find a way of attracting, we'll say, you know, single people into rooms for, say, HMO or something like that, a good area is going to be an area that has good public transport. And so they can come and go to work very easily. And this is the kind of thing that I'm talking about. A good area, a lot of the time people think just if there's low crime, that makes for a good area. That might be the place that you would like to live in yourself, but it doesn't necessarily tick the box for the people who want to live there. Young professionals, for example, they might not like the kind of area that an older couple would like. An older couple might be thinking, oh, this is a lovely quiet area. That's what makes it a good, safe area. But if you're a young person, maybe the ability to find other young people and nightlife and things like that, that's what makes it a good area. So you need to think about this in the context of, is the area that you're looking at, nice and all as it might be, is it compatible with the type of tenant that you are looking to attract? And did you think that far ahead? Like, do you want to rent to family, single person, nurses, students? Is it a good area? You know, a good area for one does not necessarily mean it's a good area for another. And so that is something to think about in the context of all of this. So my dog has just entered the room, so hopefully we won't get disturbed. But anyway, I'm going to carry on. Next thing that I see people making the mistake is they look at exclusively whether or not they can afford the property, and they don't dive into the economics of the deal. So, for example, what is the gross yield on the investment? If you're buying a property and you're paying $100,000 for it and you're earning $1,000 a month, that's $12,000 a year. So your yield, your gross yield on that is 12%. Now, 12% is not a bad rate. If you consider when you go out and borrow at the moment, you're probably borrowing at around 7% or something like that. And if you're borrowing at 7% and you're bringing in 12%, then you've got a 5% sort of spread, we'll say. And that is the difference between your cost of mortgage and your rental income. Now, the problem with that, though, is that there are other expenses that you may not have considered. If you buy an apartment, for example, there is usually a block management charge or a service charge. That is additional to your mortgage. So you've got to add that on top. And then there's maintenance. If you buy a house, you've got to put a little bit aside for stuff that goes wrong. So whether that's an appliance is broken down, whether or not there's a leak in the attic or whatever, you know, all of these things, they suddenly happen and you need to get them fixed. So you need to make sure that there's a surplus of rent to your expenses. And that is something that people often get caught on. They don't realize that, you know, it's not just the mortgage. It's lots of things. And also you've got tax to pay. If you're paying money on a mortgage, the mortgage is usually made up of a certain amount of capital and a certain amount of interest. You are only entitled to the interest portion against your income, not the capital amount. And so that is something that catches people. So what else do we have to think about? Well, you have to think about what is the market value and how does it compare to other properties in that area? A lot of the time people will say, oh, look, this place is $170,000. I can afford that. I can raise a mortgage of that amount. But how does that compare to the three other properties that have sold on that street this year? If the other properties all sold at 155 and you're paying 170, it doesn't matter that you can afford it. It matters that you're overpaying by the looks of it, unless there's a very obvious reason why it's costing more than the other properties. How much interest cover I mentioned already. How much value are you able to add yourself? Now, this is separate to the market going up. If you want to, you know, perhaps extract some of your equity later in the deal, it's always a good idea to be able to force the appreciation of the property. And what I mean by that is, if you go and buy a house, we'll say a three-bedroom house, semi-detached, maybe you can add an extension out the rear. And if you add the extension out the rear, all of a sudden you've maybe enhanced the property value. Now, you might have to spend 40, 50,000 doing that extension, but perhaps it adds 60, 70, 80, maybe even 100,000 to the value of the property. It all depends how well you do it, how well it's executed, whether or not you're able to bring savings to this deal by maybe doing the work yourself. This is one of the reasons I always say that people in the trades have quite an advantage on that strategy, because they can do a lot of the work themselves and they can bring in their mates and they can get mates rates as opposed to paying full value. If it's a good deal or not, all of that comes down to, you know, doing a little bit of checking around. How much rent can you afford, you know, to collect? If it's just a family home and you're renting it out, that's going to be less than if you split the house up into multiple units and rent it out as a HMO. I know the difference. I've seen this now and it's quite incredible. You can see a house on a street and maybe it brings in $2,500 a month or something like that in rent. The same property in the format of a HMO might bring in $5,000 a month. That's the difference that you can see between the two. And so it's important to know, you know, what way are you going to go about doing this. And so a lot of this all comes back to whether or not you're educated or whether or not you're experienced as a property investor. If you're new to all of this, well, then a lot of this is going to sound completely new. You're never going to have heard a lot of these things. And that is one of the problems that I find when people join my courses and my mastermind stuff, is that they're sitting in the mastermind, for example, and they're listening and they're hearing all these other questions and they're going, geez, I never even thought to think about that or to ask that question. And they suddenly starts to dawn on them that, whoa, I need an education in this area. That's one of the reasons I created my novice investment course called Foundations. And, you know, you can always find the link in the show notes below. But the idea is not to sell you on something. It's just not to go and get yourself caught. This is one of the problems that I see, is people go in, they think they can afford it, and that's the only criteria that they use. And when they end up going in, buying it, and then suddenly they realize, I'm stuck now, I can't add value, and I'm stuck on the same amount of rent because of rent control zones and various things like that. So be very careful not to get too far into something without knowing what you're getting into. Now, something that I've created to try to help people with this, and this is something that I teach in my course, but I'm going to go and spill some of the beans today. I use the acronym DEAL, D-E-A-L. And what I've come up with this acronym because what it means, D stands for demand, E stands for economics, A stands for approach, and L stands for location. And if you're thinking about buying a property, think about the DEAL acronym and run the property through that as a kind of a filter as to whether or not it's a good deal. Now, this is actually I'm creating a free course in my school community. And so if you join the school community, you'll actually have like a course that goes through this, specifically talking about the DEAL acronym. But let's just get into what does it stand for. D for demand, okay? What is the level of demand for in that area for the specific type of thing you have in mind? As I mentioned already, students, nurses, family home, breaking it up into, say, a professional, individual rooms for professionals, for, we'll say, single men who are working as contractors or something like that. You see that quite a lot when it comes to HMOs. So what are you going for? Is the demand there? And how can you test that demand? There are various tactics and strategies that you can use to actually test how many people are looking for that specific use in that area. And that's some of the stuff that we teach in the courses. There's also strategies on just in order to work out like which is the way to go. If you look at all three different scenarios, you have to kind of weigh up the different criteria that each of those groups would be looking for. So how far is it to walk to the nearest hospital? How far is it to walk to the college? All of that feeds into which is the best group for this. And so it's good to do a little bit of research in this area just to figure out, is the demand there before you go and buy the property? Next, we look at the economics. And I referred to this earlier when I was talking about the stuff that you need to check out. What is the loan to value ratio? That is a very important one, because when the banks are talking to you, they, if it's an investment property, certainly here in the Irish market, they're going to insist that you're putting 30% deposit down. 70% of it, of a loan will go against that. Now, I've spoken to people in the US, and the US is a much, much more flexible arrangement. And I've seen people putting down 3% and borrowing 97%. Now, that reminds me of back in 2005 when everyone was going crazy here in Ireland. So you want to be careful. Like, it's great to be able to buy a property with the minimum deposit that you can get away with, but it all feeds into the economics of the deal. And so you do have to think about it in terms of payments, in terms of what if interest rates increase? What will I be caught short, you know, 2 years from now or something like that? So don't think about it in the moment. Think about it in different scenarios. How much is the interest cover? I mentioned already, you know, the amount of rent you're getting in and the amount of interest and mortgage you have to pay. How much of a, you know, gap between those two? Is it sufficient to cover maintenance? Is it sufficient to cover your tax? Is it sufficient to be able to put aside a little bit of money for that rainy day when something goes wrong? And at the end of the day, after all of that, is there a surplus being thrown out of the deal? And can you live on that surplus? Or if you're going after capital appreciation, then you don't need to worry so much about pulling money out of the deal, but you just want to make sure that you're covering all of your expenses. Another thing to think about is, what is the value of your property versus other properties in the area? I mentioned already, do your research. Check, it's not difficult to find this stuff now. There's all sorts of price registers that you can figure out whether or not somebody has bought in the area recently, what price they paid. Certainly here in Ireland, I'm seeing the property price register. You can actually find to the exact, you know, euro, how much somebody spent on a property. And, you know, you might think that that's a bit invasive or intrusive, but the reality is this is the information out there. So we've dealt with D for demand. We've dealt with E for economics. The next is approach. A for approach. And what I mean by that is you've got to think about what is the approach you're going to take to actually extract the maximum value out of this, or what is your strategy for the property? A lot of people talk about B or. That is a strategy. That is, in the way I'm using this acronym, that is the approach. And so you could say to somebody, right, well, it's a B or strategy. That's my approach. Now, the other thing is people will look at, for example, Airbnb. People will look at lots and lots of different strategies. You might be looking at buying a commercial unit and converting it to residential, or you could be doing some of the stuff that I used to do, where you buy a large commercial and you split it into smaller. And that was hugely profitable when I used to do it. And so these are the different things you need to look, but you need to have a strategy, and you need to be able to articulate that strategy to the lender. And also, if you're going to talk to investors, you need to be able to articulate that strategy as well. Why are you opting for that strategy? What are the benefits? What kind of outcome is likely to happen if you go down that road? For example, do you buy and refurbish and extend a property, add a whole load of value, and then, as some of the clients in my mastermind are doing, you're actually able to extract almost all, if not the entire amount, of the refurbishment monies that you put into the deal. Now, that is a great thing, because then you can just go again and recycle and just keep on doing that. You put the money in, you put your deposit, you do your refurb with your cash as well, you refinance the property with its new rents and stuff, and you pull the whole lot back out, and then you go and do the next property. And you just get into a routine of doing that over and over and over. That is a fantastic approach. And that is something. The other thing is, you know, splitting the units. Lots of different ways to look at your approach. But if you can't articulate it, and if you don't know why it's the approach that you're taking, if you only know one approach and you're just trying to make that work everywhere, then that's not a great way to look at it. I teach multiple approaches in my different courses because I don't think you should be stuck having just one strategy. The reality is strategies change, the market evolves. If you're stuck with one strategy, then all of a sudden your options close very quickly. So it's a good idea to know a lot of different options and know what are the different strategies that might be applicable at any one time. And then finally, location. Now, we talked about the area, but as I mentioned, it is not just whether or not it's a good area. It's down to whether it is a good demographic fit for the clientele you're chasing. And so, as I mentioned, if you are students, you probably want to be close to the college, or at the very least, close to public transport that's going in the direction of the college. If you have to change your bus twice to get, or if you have to cycle as far as the train station and then go, that is not going to be a place that a student wants to live. If you're going to go and find a place that you're thinking would be perfect for families, they're going to need to know that there are playgrounds, that there are schools, that there is amenities in the area, that they can go like a park or whatever. All of this stuff feeds into whether or not it is a good location. It is not simply whether or not it's a low crime area or whether, you know, the area doesn't have, you know, socioeconomic problems or whatever it might be. That is my DEAL acronym. Now, that just covers four items, but I think they're the four principal items that are important. Now, when I, you know, when I'm teaching people in my course, I always go, I think there's probably 11 different areas that I would look at, but the four main ones are those four that I've described already. And you just want to make sure that you're doing as much due diligence, as we call it, as possible. If you're going and you're just buying it on a whim, that's going to just get you in trouble. You really do need to do your research, because buying a property, you know, you go through all the hoops to get the loan and things like that. But once you own it, if there's something wrong with that property, it can be very difficult to offload that property. And offload it, I mean, being able to sell it at all, let alone selling it at a loss. I've bought properties for 500,000 and I've struggled for years to sell the property. And in the end, it was put into an auction and we got 136,000 for it. That is the level of the fall of value in that particular. And that was because if I look back now on that particular deal, there was the D wasn't great and the L was very poor. The location was bad. There was a lot of crime in that area and it deterred the people that were interested in the property. And so both D and L were bad. The economics of the deal, they looked pretty good. I thought I was going to double my money. And the approach was simply buy an empty unit, fill it with a quality tenant, and that increased the value. Good approach, good economics, but poor demand and poor location. That's how I assess the deals now. So now that I've covered all that, have a look at the property you're looking at and think about it in that context. Does it stack up now? Is it as good as you thought it was? If it's good, then if you've done your homework and you can demonstrate to a lender that you've looked at all of these different things, it's going to reassure the lender or the investor or whoever. It's going to ensure them that you know your stuff, and you might not be an expert, but you will certainly have done more homework than the vast majority of people that are going in there applying for loans. And a lot of people, I believe, are probably just lucky that they managed to raise the money. They were able to, you know, just find a property for themselves, for their family home, and the banks are not quite as they don't scrutinize it quite as much when it's for your own home. If you can afford the payments, then they'll pretty much let you have it. But if it's for a rental property, you're going to need that 30% deposit. Now, this doesn't necessarily guarantee success. I mean, I've told you how I believe the lenders will look at it. But of course, nowadays, lenders have different policies. They might have internal sort of strategies and stuff that actually make them avoid that particular area or that location or whatever. If you're only speaking to one bank, that there immediately is a red flag. You should be speaking to multiple banks. People who say, well, I've been banking with this particular bank, and so I'm going to go in and I'm going to get the loan from them. It might be convenient, but it's not necessarily going to get you the deal that you want. And you might pay dearly for that, or you might just simply be turned down where other banks might have a bit more of an open mind. You also might just find that certain banks have lent to that particular, you know, property type or area. They've done an awful lot of business in that area, and perhaps they think they're a little bit exposed to that location or that, you know, economic group or demographic or whatever it might be. And they might actually resist it because of that. It's nothing to do necessarily with the property. So that's one of the reasons you have to be careful about, you know, finding the one bank and thinking that that's the one person you're going to use. People often use brokers, and brokers are good insofar as they are out there talking with multiple banks. And so you'll obviously get a deal. If you're like, more likely to get a deal with a broker than you are trying to do it all by yourself. But again, brokers also, they are economically incentivized to go and do deals with certain banks and stuff like that. So they might have their preference. I don't know the ins and outs of that. I'm actually going to bring a mortgage broker on the podcast soon for an interview to kind of learn more about all that kind of stuff. But if you limit yourself to simply the main banks, well, then I think you need to be careful, because that is, you know, the main banks, they have their size and they have, you know, the fact that they're spread out all over the country. That's a big benefit to them. And also the number of customers and the size of their balance sheet and stuff means that they get cheaper rates and they can offer you a cheaper rate. But it also makes them much more cumbersome, like a big, huge bureaucracy that's hard to get something approved. Sometimes these small niche lenders are more nimble and they can go and move quickly, but they probably cost you more. But you should be thinking about it in terms of, if you've got a deal that is like a really beautiful and it ticks all the boxes economically, like, for example, you're buying in an area and you're managing to pull the rabbit out of the hat and you're getting like a 20% yield. Like, if you've got a 20% yield, that property looks like a really good property. That is one that you want to be taking control of fairly quickly. And if you spend 6 months speaking to a bank, whereas you can spend 6 weeks getting a loan through a niche lender, then I think that might be a more sensible option. Pay slightly more, but at least you've secured a really, really good deal. You have to think about all of this stuff. And then ultimately, if the banks and the niche lenders are not going to do it, there are other sources of, you know, money out there and capital. You can go out and you can talk to private investors, private lenders. You can talk to families, and, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff. There's also various platforms. I had David Jelly on not so long ago talking about the Property Bridges platform, which is a peer-to-peer lender. My point is, you really have to have an open mind to this, and you have to be a disciplined, you know, tenacious, and somebody with a lot of perseverance. You go out and speak to one or two banks and they say no, and you think, oh, it's impossible. It's not impossible. You just haven't tried hard enough. I'm not going to suggest you go out. If you're only starting out, then I don't think it's a good idea to go and approach private investors. I don't think you know enough to have that conversation. Like, a private investor is a different person to a bank or something like that. They're going to ask you a lot of detailed questions that maybe you don't know the answer to. And I think you probably need a little bit more experience before you start going down that road. That is something that I teach in my more advanced coaching program, the Accelerator. But that is not for people that are starting out. That is for people who are experienced, who know what they're doing, and really they're just looking for, you know, some extra knowledge so that they can go out and start presenting to investors and things like that. Finally, some comments on tenacity and grit. I mentioned it already just a moment ago, but, like, I see a lot of angry comments in my social media. I see it in TikTok and I see it in Instagram and all this kind of stuff. Anytime I make a post about the property sector, I can predict that I'm going to see these kind of comments. And it's from people saying, it's impossible, you can't get money in this market or in this country. And it's a very blanket kind of no, negative attitude. And yes, it might be tough at the moment, but it is not impossible. And I do believe it's not impossible. I just think that perhaps these people haven't tried hard enough and they've given up. And that could be the issue. I talked last week, I think it was, I mentioned Walt Disney. When he was starting Disneyland back in the 50s or 60s, whenever it was, he had an idea that was very, very novel. And as we know today, Disney World, Disneyland, all that, it's an absolute like billion-dollar business. It's phenomenally successful. But when he went out, he was turned down by 300 banks. Now, have you spoken to 300 banks for your property deal? Of course you haven't. There's probably not 300 banks between Ireland and the UK. But the reality is that people give up too quickly. And I think the reality is if you really, really want it, like if you are obsessed about this and you absolutely must become a property investor, then you will achieve it. It's just you will find a way. And that is, I'm trying to be positive, but you've got that old proverb. If at first you don't succeed, try again. That is exactly how it works. Persistence is the key. If you fail, try again. If you fail again, try a different approach. If that fails, try another approach. You just keep on doing that. And I know it's annoying, and I know maybe the deal comes and goes because you weren't able to do it quick enough. But if you give up at that point, you're never going to get on this. And so it's very important to be persistent and just keep on pushing through and never really give up. I would say if this is just a passing kind of interest, then that's a different story. But if you're really serious about becoming a property investor, then you have to bring some tenacity to it and also some resilience, because you will face challenges. And you know, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you'll know the challenges that I've faced in my career. And they can be pretty bleak and they can go on for kind of a prolonged period of time. But it is definitely a worthwhile industry to be in. And so I hope this episode was useful, helpful to you guys. I hope to see you all who are listening now. I hope to see you in the school community. And if you aren't in the school community, well, then I'll see you same time back here next week. Take care. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Behind the Facade. If you enjoyed the show or found it in any way useful, could I please ask you to take a moment to leave a review over on iTunes or Spotify? This really helps us get the podcast out in front of more people. If you have any questions or topics you would like me to cover in future episodes, please connect with me via my brand new school community. You will find a link in the show notes. You can stay up to date with all of my content and the projects I'm working on by signing up for my weekly newsletter over on my website, gavinjgallagher.com. That's all for now. See you back here, same time next week.